Welcome to the Talking Biotech Podcast. It's the weekly podcast about agriculture and medicine with an emphasis on biotechnology and the good things it can do for people and the planet. My name's Kevin Folta. I'm a professor at the University of Florida. And this week we're going to talk about an event that was held in the developing world, namely in Nairobi, Kenya. And it was an event that was held mostly to apparently disparage biotechnology. But the good news is that somebody went there to see what was happening and to ask some hard questions of the participants. And we're reminded that not all heroes wear capes, especially the ones that work on lathes and engines, right? Today we're speaking with Rob Wager, and Rob is a faculty member in the bio department at Vancouver Island University in beautiful Nanaimo, Vancouver, BC, just in BC, right?
Yeah, Vancouver Island, yes.
Yeah, Vancouver Island, that's right. Across the street from Vancouver.
Yeah.
Yeah. So how's it going, Rob?
Oh, just wonderful. Thank you.
No, it's wonderful to have you on. You know, you've been an old friend and really an outstanding supporter of technology and talking about technology with the public and working on social media for a long time. And maybe I guess the best place to start is, where did you get the idea to actually visit this kind of a conference?
Well, I guess it started when I saw the advertisement online for the first international conference on agroecology in Nairobi, Kenya. And that up and by itself was fine, but what was clear was that they were importing some of the big names in the anti-GMO industry to come to this conference. And it seemed a bit strange because agroecology is more about organic agriculture as opposed to using the anti-GMO memes and falsehoods to scare the public. So I was worried that bringing these group of people to Africa would be used to try and stall the implementation of African-developed genetically engineered crops.
Yeah, and where was the conference held? I don't think we talked about that.
It was held at a very nice resort called Safari Park Resort in Kenya, in Nairobi, Kenya.
Okay, so this was kind of a conference that was really around agroecology, at least billed that way. And agroecology, you know, that's a series of disciplines which really allow you to farm with fewer inputs or different inputs. And it doesn't always necessarily have to be anti-biotechnology, or actually you could use biotechnology solutions in an agroecological context, and maybe even better. But I guess here's the question is, was there anything there to do with agroecology, or was it strictly this anti-biotech stuff?
Actually, there was a fair bit of discussions about the FAO initiative to scale up agroecology. And there was one talk that I found very fascinating on the push-pull technology. So there are applications that of this technology that could be very useful. However, a significant portion of the conference was devoted to trying to scare people away from using biotechnology.
I guess that makes sense in a way, because Africa is looking for solutions. And if you want to propose ideas, you could use agroecological solutions that are being embraced by many, or you do have biotechnology solutions, which also have their place. Do you get the feeling that the whole conference was more of an anti-biotech feel, or was it really something that was trying to promote just good farming practices?
A significant portion, if not the lion's share of the talks, were designed to denigrate modern agricultural techniques, including biotechnology, but also synthetic fertilizer use, synthetic pesticide use. They really were trying to argue that the best way forward was going back 100 years in agricultural.
But isn't that kind of true in some ways, that a lot of people on the African continent have no access to Haber-Bosch-derived fertilizers or modern pesticides? So doesn't it make sense to really train them and give them the best up-to-date research in other techniques which do not require those inputs?
That's certainly true. But when I went out to the farms in the middle of the country, it was pretty clear to me that the farmers were already using most of the techniques that were being championed at this conference as the way forward. So they were already using these techniques. And so this didn't represent any major shift in the way to grow agriculture. And what we know now, it's very clear that Africa is having a very hard time feeding itself with these techniques.
Okay, that's fair. And I guess the question then really goes to the conference itself and the participants or these speakers that were there in kind of an anti-biotech context. But maybe we should start with one other question is, you know, what, how did you get there? I mean, were you funded by the big biotech companies to, you know, go and cause trouble in the space?
No, not at all. Actually, I was successful in getting grants from my university and using my own professional development funds and securing private financing. And so the biotech industry contributed exactly $0 to my trip to Africa.
Okay, yeah, it's good to get that cleared out front because you know the claims that go with that pretty well.
Yes.
So now that we talked about who funded you, who funded the conference?
This funding was mainly from European environmental NGOs, and so that was Swiss, German, and Swedish NGOs that funded the vast majority. As well, there was funding from IFOAM, which is the International Federation for Organic Agriculture Movement, and a few other BioVision Africa Trust. So a lot of the money came from Europe to present and import these speakers into Africa.
Ah, so who were the speakers that were invited? Who's their all-star team of scientific expertise?
Yeah, the scientific expertise needs to be in quotes there. They had the infamous Seralini, who in 2012 produced the now retracted paper claiming that glyphosate and GM crops caused cancer in rats. Of course, we now know that that's completely been debunked. Then we had Tyrone Hayes, who's known for his advocacy of against using atrazine, where he claimed atrazine caused the feminization in frogs. Then we had Judy Carman, who did the infamous pig study with an organic farmer in the U.S., claiming that there was inflammation of the stomach linings, and again, highly questionable science. And finally, we finished off with Don Huber, who's a retired professor from Purdue University, who has made a major shift in his public outreach, and now he's very much against the use of glyphosate, and he has some interesting ideas about the reality of glyphosate use.
So I guess what we should probably do is just go down the list and talk a little bit about what they were presenting and what the central ideas were. Let's start out with Tyrone Hayes. Now Tyrone Hayes, you know, he has some legitimacy in that he's a professor at Berkeley. You know, the guy's got published peer reviewed manuscripts around, which, you know, seem credible around the use of, at least in controlled circumstances, that there are effects of atrazine on amphibians and amphibian development. And so what is it that he was going with that would make him most appropriate for this kind of audience?
Well, his talk really focused on atrazine particularly. And, you know, he started out with a picture of the very tragic event of the Oklahoma bombing. And so he started out trying to vilify the use of pesticides. Well, that wasn't a legitimate use of pesticide. Any technology.
Oh, yes.
And then he went on to showing deformities of poor children in the Far East when after the result of 2,4-5-T spraying and the dioxin contamination during the Vietnam War. And again, not an appropriate use of technology, and it was used to really scare the people at the audience.
Wow. And what was his central theme, though? I mean, he was talking about atrazine, but atrazine is what was replaced. atrazine went away when the onset of glyphosate was available and Roundup Ready products or glyphosate tolerant products. So what was the leg to stand on for him, and what was his major point for agroecology?
Well, he made the point that atrazine is still very widely used in the U.S., and he quoted a number of 80 million pounds of atrazine are applied on the U.S. On an annual basis. And that may very well be true, as corn or maize is naturally tolerant to this herbicide, so it may very well be still widely used. But he was hammering away at the idea that atrazine represented a major endocrine disruptor.
Okay, and so that's what's so strange, though, is that atrazine is something that is available, is out there. In the levels used, you know, you can use it safely, you know, at least from my understanding. And his major drive, though, has always been to say that this stuff is bad news. So the place where it probably is used most is on non-GE corn, non-GE sweet corn, other non-GE grasses. So it just seems strange that he would be there as part of the conference, because he really is talking about and vilifying a good technology that was replaced by something much better. And actually, if you want to go more agroecology, going towards glyphosate maybe is a better alternative.
I definitely agree. I personally think that glyphosate is one of the best agricultural compounds ever invented. It's low toxicity, it's non-persistent nature, it's breakdown products being completely non-toxic. It truly is a wonderful compound. Unfortunately, there are activists around the world who have been very successful at vilifying this particular compound, and so the myths out there are significant.
What was he wearing, a cape and doing all of his, you know, like he's very garish when you see him speak or you see him online. He, wears really cool suits and it just, you know, was he still doing that very over the top presentation style?
A little bit. He wasn't quite as garish, as you put it, as you see him often online, but he definitely was a showman at the front of the room. And one of his, things that he repeated again and again and again was that your children's children will be affected by these compounds used today. I mean, if you can't scare people by threatening their grandchildren, it was unfortunately hard to watch.
Well, those kinds of proclamations are especially effective in the African continent, where people do have their families threatened by other natural causes, whether it's disease, medical, nutritional. And so to say that, you know, this will threaten your grandchildren really hurts, really resonates with people in those countries. So that's a really sad thing to say. Was there anything else he said or did that was particularly noteworthy?
He claimed that atrazine causes a dramatic drop in sperm count in males. Now, you want to target the African male population, you tell them that they can't produce offspring. He also said that atrazine feminizes the male population. So again, if you want to really get the fear at a very high level, that's how you do it. And he did exactly that.
Well, what about good old Gilles-Éric Séralini? Was he on fire the whole time, or what was his story?
Well, his was a little bit interesting, because he was the only one of the four who didn't actually show up. He came in by video conference, and the video conference had some technical issues, which, up and by itself, we all know how that happens. So there's nothing sinister about that. But in his conference, or in his talk to the conference, none of his slides show up. So you had to just take whatever he said at face value, even though that when we as scientists look at his data, it becomes very clear that the data does not represent quality evidence of the commentation that he often puts with it.
So if you could see my slide, you would see the data that suggests that. No, but this is a common thing for him. He had a problem when he was being grilled by the National Academies of Science a few years ago, too. And it seems like technical glitches are kind of his way of dodging responsibility to produce something legitimate or hide something that could provoke reasonable criticism. And so I don't know if that was really the feeling you got there, or what do you think?
It was hard to tell. You know, the way his video conference went, right from the very beginning where he was having problems with sound and everything, I have a feeling it was more innocent, and he just didn't have a good handle of the system he was working with.
Okay, so I'll give him a break there. But what about when you look at the fact that his paper, when that came out in 2012, so 7 years ago almost, it immediately shut down interest in GE crops from the Kenyan government. So here you are in Kenya, where he successfully, single-handedly shut down development of these technologies for people that really need them. And do you think it was more of a question of he doesn't want to show his face in Kenya? And I mean, is he looked at as a hero or as someone who truly is a villain in that country?
Without a doubt, his work had a significant impact in blackballing genetically engineered crop research by the Kenyan scientists. And they've got some wonderful products that are working their way through the regulatory system. But since we've seen in the last few years, there's been four major studies out of Europe using European money, using proper controls, using proper methodology, using proper statistics that have all failed to reproduce his infamous 2012 paper. So I think we can safely say that 2012 paper has been thoroughly debunked.
Yeah, absolutely. It not just was it appropriately criticized in the beginning, but now you've had four other organizations not reproduce it. And what's really sad about that is that not one of them got any substantial coverage, fanfare, pasting all over the internet like that image of the three rats that still exists today in most forms online. And it just has incredible staying power. But what is he up to today? Did he talk about any of his current work or any current claims?
He has shifted away from doing talking about that 2012 one, except for the fact that he's still using the samples from those poorly designed experiments, and now he's moved into metabolomics and transcriptomics, the methods of tracking gene expression and protein production, and now he's making all kinds of grandiose negative claims using apparently the new modern techniques.
Yeah, which is really funny because when you go back to that original paper and he's saying, look at the tumors and how sick these animals are, and we all remember the really grotesque pictures of the animals that looked like they were, you know, stuffed full of ping pong balls. It was horrible what they did to those animals. But now you take samples from them and say, look at these samples that say these animals are sick. You know what I mean? It's kind of a cyclical problem. You're trying to say, look how dangerous these products are, and whether it's the corn or the glyphosate, and then you take your samples from sick animals to show that. So in other words, it's kind of a self-fulfilling prophecy. It's not saying that those inputs of corn and glyphosate cause the cancer. It says that when an animal with extreme cancer that's really sick is going to have screwed up metabolomics and transcriptomics.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. It was almost laughable when you could see that he was claiming that when using those extremely sick rats, I mean, they had tumors that were over 50% of their body mass, very sick, and then to claim that I'm using their samples to prove something completely different, it's, as you say, self-fulfilling circular science. I wouldn't call it science, but he does.
Well, yeah. Well, but it's the old story. A dog with no legs doesn't jump through a hoop. And that's kind of his, but he's still, he's putting the hoop over the dog and saying, look it, jump through. And because it's a way of, or a better example is the idea, I don't remember what fallacy they call this, but where you shoot an arrow at the side of a barn and then draw the target around it and say, look it, I hit it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And unfortunately, because a lot of the audience is not trained in the scientific disciplines, they just lap this up as one of the promoters of the talk, he kept saying, evidence, 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 that's what you've just seen. And I'm sitting back going like, no, I saw lots of bluster. I saw no evidence whatsoever. And all I saw was a fear campaign.
Yeah, but you're there in the audience. And so did you get to raise your hand and say, wait a minute, you know, this isn't real data?
Well, unfortunately, we were not allowed to ask questions of Sarah Leaney.
Of course. So he did not allow anyone to ask questions after his session?
Well, I guess apparently the technical problems overtook the presentation. So once his presentation was done, we were pretty much left with no recourse to address any of the comments that he had made.
Wow. Well, that also, though, is part of a pattern. And, you know, we've seen that before.
Definitely. Definitely true.
Yeah, so that, well, you know, that's another data point. You know, that evidence, 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 right? If there was one theme from across all of these presenters that they maybe came together with, and, you know, we've talked already about Hayes and Sarah Leaney, and what were all of them kind of tying it together with?
It's interesting. One of them always started out with the same theme, that regulators around the world are incompetent or are in cahoots and therefore are not protecting the public. They then presented their evidence, as it would be, and at the end, they always finished off with regulators are not to be trusted, we know the real science, and regulators are not protecting the public.
Okay, it's all the regulators, but also all the other scientists in the world. Like nobody else sees that, you know, this thing that's producing a huge amount of our food has problems, and nobody else seems to find it except for, you know, this handful of usual suspects. But that's how they're pitching this. And how is the audience reacting to that?
Well, you know, it's interesting. These people are good showmen. They're terrible scientists, but they're very good showmen. And they convince the public by putting up what amounts to junk science that they are, in fact, the ones who are looking out for the public. And only they understand how to do the science properly to demonstrate these alleged problems.
Well, let's talk for a second about Judy Carman. Now, Judy Carman came to light back in the, I don't know, maybe now that paper's pretty old too. That probably goes back to, what, 2014 or 13, where she showed, made a claim in a rather obscure online journal on sustainable farming that pigs fed corn, GE corn, had more stomach lining irritation. And you remember these pictures where they showed three pig stomachs, and some were a little pink, and they ranked all of the stomachs by high, medium, and low. I don't remember even the exact details of why it was such a poor study, but it was one of these things that we kind of just wrote off. Here we are, what, 6 years later, and never was reproduced or followed up. But it probably was because she was busy doing better studies at higher resolution with more numbers and better techniques, right? And that's what she presented in Kenya.
Well, almost. She has now teamed up with a faculty member from the University of Adelaide. They presented what they claimed was definitive evidence of in rats that were fed GM corn.
Now, you're talking about Carmen and her collaborator, who I think was Irina Zadarsky or Ziadarsky. They did some experiments that apparently attempt to follow up on that pig study that was never that was a dead in the water one-off study. Nobody else followed up on it. They didn't follow up on it. It just was DOA. But what did the rat study tell us?
Well, that was very interesting. If you look, I was completely unaware of this paper that they were citing during this talk. And usually I'm pretty up to date on most of the scientific literature, both good and poor quality science. And so I was completely unaware of this paper. So they presented evidence that apparently showed that in rats, when you fed them 60% diet, 50 or 60% diet of corn, which we know is beyond the reasonable amount of food in a rat diet, OECD has very strict regulations on how animal feeding trials should be done, and they max out at 30% or 33%. So they gave far too much corn to these rats. They used corn from two different continents, one from North America for the test and one from Australia for the controls. Well, of course, we know that that is just very poor way of doing a feeding trial. At the end, they showed one or two pictures of what appeared to be small openings in the gap junction between individual cells lining the gut of rats. So I thought this was really interesting that I'd never seen this paper, and I'm not a histologist, so I couldn't quite see where there may be issues with this particular science. So I went back to my room and downloaded the paper and read the paper, and then I thought, well, oh, it's been out a year now. Who cited it? And in the year that it's been published, one citation has occurred, and that was from an anti-GMO organization in Europe. So clearly the scientific community around the world did not see quality within this paper.
Well, but that's not terribly uncommon. But methodologically, not only was it completely different corn, one from the U.S. that was a triple stack type corn, and the other one not, was in Australian and just, you know, some corn strain. They don't even identify what it is. They also used 10 rats in each group for 6 months. It just was a very weak study. But of course, how strong were their claims and what were they claiming from this?
Oh, again, they started out with attacks on the Australian regulators, the Australian New Zealand Food Safety Authority, and saying that these people simply do not know how to do proper toxicology studies, but we do, and here's what we found. And then, of course, after presenting that data, they had the audience well in their hand, and then they ended up with saying, this is a way toxicology studies should be done, and that the regulators should not be trusted, and we know what's really going on.
Especially when they say that when they do the studies so poorly, using non-isogenic lines, bad controls basically, ad libitum feeding of water and food, so you can eat as much as you want. Just right there, it changes the entire dynamic of the study, because if the GE corn has more, you know, oil or fat or something in there that the rats like, they'll put on more weight and they won't be as healthy, and has nothing to do with the genetics. It has to do with the amount you're fed. And so anyway, we can go into the details of debunking papers another time, but it just is strange that here they are years after this paper that had all this visibility, again, like the Seralini paper, falling flat without any additional evidence to follow up or show anything new.
Yeah, the very basics of science is reproducibility. And yet, in all these cases, of all four of these people, the claims that they are making have simply not been reproducible.
So we'll continue with more discussion of Rob's ventures in Africa right after the break. We're talking to Rob Wager, who's a faculty member of the biology department at Vancouver Island University. He recently went to a conference on agroecology in Africa and is giving us a report of some of the exciting things he saw. This is the Talking Biotech Podcast, and we'll be back in just a minute.
Tune into the podcast on Saturday, August 17th, 2019. It's the 200th episode of the Talking Biotech Podcast.
Science.
One day after Elvis' death day, more guests sharing their solutions for people and the planet.
gene editing to cure animal disease,
new therapies for cancer and viral disorders,
next generation crop technologies for sustainable farming. Screaming out of the gate with new technologies in the race to feed 10 billion people.
High nutrient crops, less resource dependence, fewer pesticides, and more sustainability. Biotechnology.
Countering disinformation that generates fear, uncertainty, and doubt that is impending technology from reaching the industrialized world farmer and the food insecure.
Saturday,
August 17, 2019, the 200th episode of the Talking Biotech Podcast. TalkingBiotechPodcast.com.
TalkingBiotechPodcast.com.
And now we're back on the Talking Biotech Podcast. We're talking with Rob Wager. He's a faculty member in the biology department at Vancouver Island University in beautiful Nanaimo, BC, where the sturgeon are large and the rabbits are everywhere.
Yeah, very true, very true.
Yeah, that was a lot. I actually was out there about a year and a half ago, and that was really nice to be able to come out with Nina Fedoroff and take a ride on the shuttle over, or whatever that was, on the ferry over across the bay there. That was really a nice trip. So we were there for Food Evolution.
Yeah, it was my honor to have both you and Nina come and participate in the screening of Food Evolution at my university. It was a tremendous success.
Yeah, I thought that was really nice. It was really cool. It had a lot of friends from Vancouver Island show up, which was kind of interesting. That was a lot of fun. And I mean that in a good way. Friends like actual friends, not friends in quotes like people with signs. So if we go back to the discussion about the conference, the other participant was my old buddy, Dr. Don Huber. What was his main thesis?
Well, you know, it was interesting. We've been following Don Huber since, 2012 or 2013, when he claimed to have found a brand new pathogen that crossed kingdoms. And, of course, your efforts to help him identify this new pathogen were, of course, denied, but he never made any mention whatsoever of this alleged pathogen that 13 years later, whatever, has no evidence to support it. What he did do, though, was he spent well over an hour listing one after another falsehoods about glyphosate, of how it is the most evil compound on the planet, and it apparently is responsible for everything from severe halitosis to cancer in both plants and animals.
Yeah. Well, that was 2011 when he first made the claim about the secret organism. And he wrote this letter as a emeritus faculty member and as a former member of the U.S. military, where he had some higher up role in military. He wrote this letter to the USDA Ag Secretary, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack. And he basically, in my mind, committed fraud. That when you go to the U.S. government, the highest branches of government, and then create a false story, you know, right there, the guy seems a little off his rocker. And I asked him a few years later, you know, when he gave a talk in my town about, oh, well, this thing is everywhere and it's killing people and killing animals and killing plants and absolute crisis. And the audience was stunned. And during question and answer session, you know, everybody kind of went, oh, geez, you're going to ask him a question and, you know, grill the guy. I said, no, I'm going to offer him some assistance. Said, you know, we sequenced the strawberry genome a few years ago. We can sequence your organism's genome and we can stop this crisis. And he spent 20 minutes talking about how it has no genetic material, that it's a, you know, such a crazy organ. It doesn't have any DNA or RNA. And then wrote a really nasty letter to my university saying that I was disruptive and needed anger management and all this stuff. And I didn't say a peep. Luckily, I recorded it. But so he didn't even mention the organism anymore?
Not a word. And I was a little bit surprised by that. But what he did do was scare the living daylights out of everybody in that room. He went on for well over an hour stating all kinds of things. One of the things that really surprised me is that he started his talk with a statement which, strangely, might be very true. He said that he does not know of a single peer-reviewed paper that shows that GM foods are safe. I thought, well, okay, that's several thousand papers that actually demonstrate the safety and utility of this, but maybe he's just not aware of those actual papers.
That's funny. That's a good way to put it. But it's also strange for a scientist to say, you know, I'm unaware of something that proves something safe, you know, knowing very well that you can't prove a negative, right? You can't show that something is safe. You can just demonstrate a lack of harm.
Yeah, exactly.
Under certain conditions. So for, and I understand the public doesn't think of that the same way, but this guy's claiming to be a very well-decorated, credible scientist, and it would be good for him to kind of follow those very basic rules that we all abide by. But what were some of his other claims?
Oh, he started out with, as I say, that one, and then the first thing out of his mouth was that glyphosate persists in the environment and has a half-life of 22 years. Now, of course, we know that the half-life is somewhere around 40 days, and it breaks down into completely non-toxic compounds. But then he goes on to say that glyphosate gives plants a bad case of AIDS. Now, in Africa, AIDS is decimating a significant portion of the population. So this would resonate and cause fear in the people in the audience, guaranteed.
Wow, so plant AIDS.
Yes.
That really is horribly insensitive, too, when so many people have lost parents and grandparents, and you know, many people are existing with HIV, even in the lack of a lot, oftentimes, proper medical care. I don't know. I don't know that I would have gone there if I were him. That just sounds like a real backfire. Do you think that that made people more afraid, or do you think that people were a little offended by that kind of thing?
I think it added to the fear factor. And as I say, he spoke for an hour, over an hour, and each statement was building on that fear more and more and more. He claimed that glyphosate stimulates and increases the virulence of pathogens. He claimed that it was a powerful antibiotic. He claimed this magic that at 12 parts per billion in an acre, it will inhibit 100% of the uptake of magnesium. And I thought, man, oh man, I thought homeopathy had it down.
Well, especially because what's the, you know, if you know the molarity of magnesium in a field,
yeah,
you know, and people have done that math. You can look at Stephen Duke and others have said in their papers very clearly that if you just look at the math of what's present in the field and in the plant and in soil, it's going to take a little more than 12 parts per billion to be able to bind or sequester or chelate all of that magnesium. So, yeah, he doesn't, for a scientist, he doesn't really pay much attention to the science.
Very true. One of the other things that I thought was really interesting was that at one point he said that we can now detect 100% of the glyphosate and its breakdown products that has been applied to a soil in the past 20 years. And then later on, he goes on to say that we have a method where we can completely get rid of the glyphosate in one season. So those are completely diametrically opposed ideas. But he managed to sell both.
Well, that's usually how he works. Did he make the claim? I know when I saw him, he was talking about how GE crops and probably glyphosate, how they cause all of the diseases in humans.
Oh, yeah. He had a list of 40-odd diseases. He basically put up the CENEF papers that are claiming all manners of ills to humans and plants are caused, in fact, by glyphosate. He put up a pictures of, apparently there was an anencephaly outbreak in Yakima county in Washington State, and he claimed that that was due to glyphosate. He claimed that this is really interesting. By 2020, that's next year, half of the children in the United States will be autistic.
Yeah, I think that follows up on – he bumped Senef's numbers 5 years forward. She said by 2025, and we're, you know, the funny part is we're getting there, and I don't know that that's going to follow through. Are most of these people, do you think, and when you look at guys like Huber or Senef, that, you know, are they kind of counting on the Grim Reaper to save them from their own misinformation?
Well, if they don't get that outcome, they're going to not look very good when the time comes and all their prophecies have fallen completely flat. Did you know that there's actually 17 mechanisms of carcinogenesis? I did not know that. There's exactly 17, and glyphosate activates all 17 of them.
I think there's a few more than 17, and it also shows a complete ignorance of pharmacology. If we believe the numbers of what people claim are on food, you know, the parts per billion in, you know, oat products or whatever, how that can be a legitimate level when in the face of how this stuff gets through cells, how this stuff gets metabolized, how it gets moved in the body. We know it's excreted in urine and stools with a small amount metabolized by the liver. So it just seems very strange that – but then again, you know, the folks who are doing this are not necessarily playing by the rules of science. So their role is to go scare people about it, and that's about it. And that seems to have been Huber's plan now for many years.
Oh, yeah. He had all kinds of claims. He claims that glyphosate causes chronic botulism poisoning in animals. Of course, Allison Van Inen showed that 100 billion animals, and we can't find that evidence. So, interesting. What else? Oh, yeah. Glyphosate accumulates in all your tissues, including your brain tissue. But he knows of a product that will detoxify you, all your tissues, except for brain tissue.
So wait, tell me more about this product. Is it the same one that detoxifies soil, or does he have like a whole product line of things that you can, or, you know, is this his products or are they things of his affiliates?
Yeah, see, he didn't go into it much, but I was just, at that point, it was very near the end of his talk, and he clearly had the audience scared out of their minds. And then, of course, he offers this miracle cure that will, for a fee, of course, that will save them from the evils of glyphosate, which is poisoning the world.
Really? So where do you find the miracle cure?
You know, I wish I had written it down better, but I didn't. I was just so amazed that he had the gumption to actually say that I've got the cure for you.
It was
something.
Well, that is pretty amazing. And so did you get to ask him any questions?
Yes, I asked him. I specifically took the quotes from his colleagues at Purdue who said that what he was saying about plant diseases is not backed up by the evidence. And instead of actually answering my query as to why his colleagues at Purdue did not agree with him, he went on and started attacking you.
Great. So it's my fault that you asked a question that he couldn't answer.
Something like that, yes.
Yeah. Did he show the picture of me in the jester hat?
No, but he was making all kinds of rather disparaging remarks about you and your personal life. And it was, again, and that was immediately after saying that people can't challenge my science, so they attack me. And then he proceeded then to carry on and attack you.
Yeah, well, that's nice. That's nice that he goes personal life on it, too, especially when, you know, the people out there have that so well figured out. You know, the funny part is all the stuff people say that's being propagated, no one's ever asked me about what this is or if it's true because they know it's not. So, you know, why get reality into this? Was there anything else from Huber that really you wanted to talk about?
Let's see. The glyphosate in all vaccines. So that would mean that we shouldn't use vaccines. Yeah, it's just amazing. He quoted Seralini's work again. He was one other one I thought was rather interesting. Apparently glyphosate is responsible for the olive die-off in Italy. I thought it was a bacterial disease, but what do I know?
Yeah, and he also has made the claim that it causes the citrus greening disease here in Florida. So he's been very much in the spotlight of blaming all plant disease on a chemical that, you know, when he was a faculty member and he was in the plant pathology department, I wonder what caused plant disease back then. You know, it just is, it's very strange for him to be able to make those claims. So when you look back at all of this, were you able to really get any time yourself, you know, as an expert who had a counter idea? Did anyone from the media or from the conference come talk to you and say, you know, hey, we really would like to hear more about what you think as someone in the science side?
Yes. In fact, I was very fortunate to have people on the ground in Africa help me communicate with the media there. And I did a variety of media, both television and print. And so I was actually quite successful in getting the other side of the story out to the public. And I also helped the media understand why these fear stories that these people had said were not to be believed. So it was actually a rather good trip from my point of view.
And I didn't really ask in the beginning, and I should have. What was the audience composition at this kind of conference?
It was pretty mixed. There was about just under 200 people there, I guess. A lot of them were organic farmers or people who wanted to learn how to do that type of agriculture better. And that's a very reasonable thing to do. But there was also the very diehard anti-GMO people. And there were some government people in the audience who just sat and listened to what was going on.
Did you get any time with the government folks?
I did meet with the National Biosafety Authority, and it was very refreshing to have discussions about the science and where the science leads us. And they're completely on board with a global consensus on this technology and how it can be used in an appropriate manner to help feed the people and grow agriculture in a more sustainable manner in Africa. So they understood the science very well, and that was gratifying, and but they don't engage the anti industry at all.
Well, it would seem really strange for them to bring people all the way, you know, across the world for a conference without having them participate in more events. So did all of these folks go to other universities or have media junkets and media, you know, interaction there in Nairobi?
There wasn't much other than the last day of the conference. Judy Carman and her colleague rented time at the university, and then with the billing that GMOs, are they safe? And so she was going to tell the same story that she had told about her rats at the university. So that was about the only one that was off-site from the conference itself.
How did that end up going for them? I mean, if they're doing this thing off-site, did you go to that or did you attend it?
I did attend it, and it was rather interesting outcome. I showed up at the time that the talk was supposed to happen, and the students showed up at the time the talk was supposed to happen, and there was no Carmen. So we're sitting there for half an hour at least, and there's still no Judy Carmen. And so I took it upon myself, being an educator, I have a student body here, why don't I talk about what I know to be real of this technology? And so I talked for about 20 minutes explaining the global opinions and the scientific consensus on the safe use of this technology and the history of safe use of this technology. And then eventually, after it's getting close to an hour, somebody came and whispered in my ear that I had to stop talking or else I would have to pay for the room. And I said, well, thank you very much. I'm done now. And so I went back to my seat and I thought, well, I best probably leave now because I doubt I'm going to be well received in that room once the people come. And the students flooded me. They took every business card I had. And I clearly didn't take enough business cards. And then I left. And as I was leaving, Judy and her colleague came. I saw them getting off the elevator an hour plus late. And then they went in and gave their talk. My understanding is it was the same situation where people in the audience who knew about the real science, and I met a wonderful person from AATF there, he was unable to ask any questions afterwards as well.
Wow. AATF, they have an outstanding presence, and everything is about development of technology for Africa, a place where it's sorely needed. So, it's just so funny about that university thing you did there. You pooped the party, man. That's pretty cool.
Well, it wasn't planned. It just happened. If they had actually arrived even close to the time where they were supposed to have began their talk, I would have just sat there and listened to their talk. I would have attempted to ask questions afterwards. But, you know, what's an educator to do when he's sitting full in a room full of students with nobody at the front of the room? I just did what I do.
Yeah. But it also frames a good opportunity for anyone listening that, you know, there is a role for the respectful party pooper. Don't let these things happen in a vacuum and don't let them happen without having somebody there to at least ask a hard question or two, because the people who are there, 20% are diehard anti-biotech, anti-GM people, whatever, coming to see one of their heroes. But the other 80% are people who don't know much about it, who are kind of interested in learning more. And for them to get a one-sided false impression is unfair to them. And it's important for someone in the audience to stand up and say, you know, there are alternative viewpoints to this that are really important, and especially in the context of feeding people. Really, we have to look at very carefully. So, you know, and asking some important hard questions. And it's good that you were able to take advantage of that situation. Maybe we need to organize a club to do this, you know, the Science Party Pooper Club or something.
Yes, yeah. It was pure happenstance. It wasn't planned at all. It just sort of unfolded in front of me, and it turned out to be, I've since got emails from some of the students who want to know more about this, and I agree with you. Whenever I get in front of an audience, I would say the vast majority of the audience are really there to just learn more because they don't know what to believe. There's so much misinformation out there on the internet that it does honestly scare them. Their fear is real, but what they want to know is that fear justified? And that's where people like you and I are always out there explaining what the real science says and explaining why the fear stories are not to be believed.
Yeah, and more important, you know, for those listening, you know, the leading with why it's important. And we always talk about and that's why science tends to lose these discussions. You've got a guy up there saying, I'm a, you know, emeritus professor from a Big Ten university, and here's this stuff that's killing you, versus someone like you or me who says, yeah, this stuff has some benefits. It's got some risks. You can understand how to use it properly and safely. And you see how we have to speak as scientists. And that's why it's so important for us to lead with the why, that in a place like Africa that has been neglected for so many years, that has been the victim of exploitation, imperialism, other problems with Africa, the, you know, disease and the lack of attention from the world. Not that there aren't outstanding organizations working hard there, they are, but for them to be targeted by these kinds of organizations to be fed more misinformation is just off the charts wrong. And great that you were able to get in there and talk about why it's important for us to be able to support technology for people that need it.
Yeah, absolutely. And the reason I went there is because it's very clear that Africa has been quite active. I think there's 26 countries with active R&D programs on genetically engineered crops. So this is African scientists making African GE crops to deal with African problems. Who would fight that? And unfortunately, this conference was designed to specifically instill fear so that the movement of these products from research and development into commercialization was not going to happen, exactly as the Seralini paper did in 2012. It shut down Kenya. So when I got there and I was able to meet with lots of people, after the conference was over, I thought, well, I wonder whether it made a difference. And as I was sitting in the airport, ready to leave Nairobi, the president of Kenya announced on national TV that he had instructed his agriculture ministry to fast-track the remaining hurdles in order to get BT cotton commercialized for the small farmers in Kenya. And that was, I felt so good.
That's amazing. It's, that kind of technology is something that's sorely needed there, and something that was derailed by the Seralini paper back in whenever that was, in 2012. And do you get the sense from people you talk to there that things are changing?
Definitely, definitely. You've got Nigeria that has now commercialized two, they've got BT cotton and BT cowpea that are now being released to their farmers. Kenya will very soon release BT cotton to their farmers. And I went to the national performance trials and saw what these BT cotton plants looked like and the potential they had. And a mere kilometer away from there, where a farmer had four or five bolls on his plant, he had already sprayed a half a dozen times and probably had to spray another half dozen times, versus the national performance trials where there are 150 bolls on the plant. That's the technology that could be in the hands of small-scale farmers, and hopefully very soon will.
How do you think time will look back at the people that laid on the ground in front of the steamroller? You know, I see the folks like Seralini and, you know, Huber especially. Why would you want to take, especially for Huber, what was a very reasonable career where he had good contributions? You have people who speak of him very positively as a plant pathologist at Purdue. And why would you go out on such a note of, he must know that what he's saying is not true? And what is driving that? And especially how do you think time will look at folks like this who stood in the way of technology for Africa?
Yeah, what drives these folks? That's a mystery to me. I don't know whether it's financial, whether it's notoriety, whether it's what. I don't know, because As you say, with Huber, he was a quality scientist at one point in time. Tyrone Hayes did some good work. Interesting enough, one of his papers looked at atrazine and frogs in North America, and in his own abstract, it said they could not find any feminization. But you know, he didn't talk about that. Why they do it is hard to know. How they will be viewed in history, I don't think it's going to look favorably upon them. One of the comments made by a TV host where I did an interview just before I left, he said, there's no stopping an idea whose time has come. It's such an interesting statement that it's clear that Africa is moving ahead with the development of genetically engineered crops for African problems. And it's also clear that money out of Europe is going to try to stop this from happening. So although I was there for this one conference, I think it's reasonable to assume that they are going to continue to try and generate fear in Africa about using this safe technology.
Wow, that's a great way to go out. Let's put a bow on it here. Hey, Rob, thank you very, very much for joining me today. I really appreciate you taking the time for sharing this with us today. If people want to learn more about you and what you do, where can they find you on social media?
I'm at RobertWager1, the number one, Twitter, and I'm also on Facebook. I think it's just Robert Wager on Facebook. And my website is robertwager.com. And all three of those are platforms that I'd love to talk with people about what the science says, what the science doesn't say, and where its application is. Because the reality is we need the best of every technology if we're going to grow more food more sustainably on the same or less land.
Wow, you just nailed it. You know, if we're going to have sensible intensification because we don't have more land, we're going to need all tools on the table. And that's the best of agroecology. It's the best of biotechnology. And that's the way we're going to solve these problems. Thanks again, Rob. It was really nice talking to you.
It was definitely my pleasure. We'll talk soon.
And as always, thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Your reviews really matter. We've been looking at them lately, and it's fantastic to see the good things you find in this particular podcast. We're very excited to follow up on your suggestions. So if you think of someone you would like to hear, or if you'd like to co-host an episode, be my guest in getting a hold of me ASAP. Thank you so much for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast, and we'll talk to you soon. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review of this podcast on iTunes and recommend it to a friend. More downloads help us reach a wider audience with science.